Welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, hosted by Dr. Ryan Mauley and Travis Buzzell. Join us on this journey as we educate the patient population, inform today's medical providers, and inspire tomorrow's medical leaders through education and in-depth discussion. We can all discover today's best healthcare solutions. Now, sit back and enjoy Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, Private Practice Podcasters.
Amanda, one of the things I really wanted to ask you is, and we talked about this a little bit before we started recording today, is if a young physician or say a mid-career physician comes to you and says, hey, Amanda, I'm very dissatisfied with my current, employment. I'm employed by this hospital or I'm employed by this group. I'd like to get out on my own. Like, can you walk us through the steps on how to do that? I did that back in 2017, started my own practice in 2018. I didn't have a manual. I didn't have a coach. I kind of figured it out and maybe got lucky a couple of times and started to put a team together. But how can you give us the manual for that?
Absolutely. So I do this all the time. I help doctors start practices. The first thing I always say, okay, is it's a business. Don't kid yourself. You have this great skill and you are a physician, just like I'm a lawyer, but you're starting a company. And there's some just basic things that you need to know when you start a company, right? Like, do you have some savings, set aside? If not, you have a business loan. You probably need to do a basic pro forma to try to figure out how you're going to survive the first couple of months. Do you have a lease for space? So these are like the just bare bones, where are you going to physically be located? Do you have any idea of a business plan or like how to run a company? Or do you have any money to start with or have ability to get a loan? And then, we just sort of take it step by step. And I'm like, okay, so that's check one. You have a location. Check two, you're going to get a business loan. You set up your company. Look, you're getting there. Every step, matters. And then we go to the next step, which is, okay, are you going to accept insurance? Are you going to be a cash-based practice? If you accept insurance, let's talk about what credentialing looks like. And let's get those plans set up, right? Get lined up with Medicare and all your commercial payers. And then next, we have to talk about the policies and the procedures in your office. What I've learned with doctors is if I just have a phone call and I just spew all of that at them, they're like, oh my gosh, I just feel so overwhelmed. How does everyone know this? So I make it real, I dummy it down. I have a real clear checklist that I say, okay, start here, then go here, then go here. And, look at it all, take your time, absorb it. But you need to know that you are running a company. And so you're going to treat it just like any other business that you would start.
How often are you finding that, and I know this guy specifically, he does. I mean, that's all he wants to do is make stuff that doesn't exist and make everyone make it his own. But like, are you finding that is, I mean, obviously you've created a pitch thing, so it's a need, right?
Yeah. So it's funny. When I started as a rep, I had several doctors that actually wanted to create products and I had nowhere to bring them. The companies we worked with would slow know them to death, which was, take 4 to 6 months, bring them out to dinner, tell them we're going to do it. And then all of a sudden they just don't do it. And then I got into my role at Stryker in the marketing position. Next thing I know, almost every rep that I'm working with globally has, hey, I have a doc that has an idea. Can you help with it? And we just couldn't do anything about it. So the problem was much bigger than I originally thought. And that's why we did this, because there was physicians all over the place. Now it's funny. We're growing through the power of LinkedIn. Just kind of watching what physicians are posting, who's saying, hey, I want to develop a product. And then even going just from the rep level as well, trying to find distributors who are working with product lines that want to be able to develop something. So it's a bigger problem than I originally thought as a rep.
So how big is PitchSync right now? Like, how many employees do you have?
Three. So we have three of us on board full time now. We've got an advisory panel. The fun thing is we found ways to run extremely lean with our platform and our development, and a lot of automation through it. It is, however, our network of consultants, we've got a couple hundred consultants globally over seven different countries.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, the consultancy network is massive, and it's an average of 18 years of experience. And there's a very highly qualified group of individuals on the platform, but the company itself is pretty small. And we want to stay that way. We want to be able to move stealthily and be able to innovate and redevelop anything that our consultants or clients need. And it's worked well for us so far.
So how long has Pitch Tank been live?
3 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. Cause I was checking the website out and obviously just doing my due diligence and, you know, piqued curiosity. And it's like this thing, that's when I said, you know, relatively launched. I mean, you guys are fresh.
How do you have that many consultants in 3 weeks?
So this is fun. We haven't even spent a dollar in marketing. It's been all word of mouth and all organic growth. What we really did was we went and found other platforms that were doing medical device consultancy or agencies, and we just found those people who were unhappy with what they were doing, and then essentially poached them from there. We wrote LinkedIn messages, got in contact with as many people as possible. I jumped on a call with every single person that's gone on our platform and told them, this is the mission. This is what we want to do. We want to do more than a platform. We want to build a community. We want to build a community that's empowering physicians, innovators, but we want to build a community that's empowering our consultants. And we want to make sure that we're taking everything that's frustrating from the consultant side and addressing that on our platform. So it's fun because our community, a lot of our consultants came up with our pricing strategies as well as payment strategies. So it's truly a platform for the people, by the people of MedDevice.
The obstacle truly is the way. And private practice, I feel like, has a ton of obstacles right now, but there's so much upside. So if I had to give you kind of like the David Letterman, red carpet, healthcare solutions, top five main areas to focus on for success in private practice, what would they be? Let's start with number five, to the most important.
Okay. So I think that, coalition with like-minded people. So if it means, if you have a large group, everyone getting on the same page, if you're in a smaller group, then, getting into arrangements with other groups and just learning from each other. I think that's extremely important. That may be actually number one or two.
That's okay. We can shift them around. Yeah. Just list them. And then as you're talking, you can always shift them up or down.
Yeah, yeah. I think thinking outside the box, realizing that in our current reimbursement environment with Medicare reimbursement going down a ridiculous amount and continuing to go down and the commercials following that, we've got to think outside the box about alternative streams of revenue, whether that be through ancillaries or through getting into value-based care. That's important. Three, I think, is having a very strong governance in your practice, from top down to bottom, getting everybody involved. You have to have all hands on deck to survive and to come up with new ideas, come up with new ways to do things. And everyone has to have an open mind to adapt and bring in new ideas and do new things in order to keep going. That may be five. I think the other ones may be one and two. Relationships with outside entities are extremely important. Even though you're competing with the hospital, I think you have to have a good relationship with your local hospital. Through co-management agreements, even some joint, consideration of joint ventures for ASCs and imaging centers. You got to keep that relationship open because, with what we do, even if we get up to 85, 90% of outpatient stuff, we still need our hospital. And you don't want to be in such a competitive mode where there's animosity between the two. So you got to have the outside relations. And I think advocacy is also very important. Each group should, if they're large enough, should have their own pack. And everyone should contribute to the pack and have a voice locally, which are state and local governments, and then also use the academy, use if you remember, OrthoForm used those for the more national issues. But if we're not at the table and we don't have a voice in things, we're going to get crushed.
That's a great five.
Yeah, I love it. And
the body, again, is way smarter than we are. It's giving us signals that something's wrong. And so these are really kind of like distress signals saying, I need something. You're like, you need to help me. Trying to give somebody a drug to treat a distress signal is not the way to do it. And so I don't think the body's making a mistake. I think it's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. And so it's just...
Expand on your analogy earlier about the gaslight going off?
Yeah.
Well, what's even taking it to the next level is the hospital system and whatever you want to call it, the American Heart Association, all the food pyramid, everything. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, we'll shut the gas light off, but let's also just put diesel fuel in your gas engine.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, because our car, our bodies are screaming at us with symptoms, whether it's hypertension, whether it's dyslipidemia, whether it's hyperinsulin, everything, metabolic disease. Yeah. And we are doing the exact opposite of what we really need to be doing to help our car engines.
There was a study that came out in 2023 that looked at the metabolic health of Americans, and it looked at 58,000 people. And only 6.8% of people were metabolically healthy, looking at five parameters of heart disease. So there was looking at BMI, hypertriglyceridemia, or hyperlipidemia, and then it was looking at, didn't look at waist circumference, it was looking at high blood pressure, a couple other, and I can't remember the other metrics, but glucose was another one.
Yeah, so, I think Peter Attia was just talking about this on the drive.
Yeah, I mean, only 6.8% of people are metabolically healthy. And then what they do is, you know, I'm writing a blog about this right now, about how they get reference ranges. So when you look at reference ranges, and physicians have become very just, they just think that reference ranges are accurate. And so how they get reference ranges is they take this parametric data that comes in and they say, okay, you have to have at least 120 samples, and they run the 120 samples on seemingly healthy people. Well, we know that 93% of people are unhealthy, but some people can look seemingly healthy and be unhealthy. So they run it, and then they'll get the mean, and then they'll get the standard deviation, and two standard deviations above and below the mean. That's how you get your reference range. So we're comparing ourselves to sick people. And so when people come in and they have, you know, 20 years ago, when your normal ALT and AST was 0 to 25, now it's 13 to 53 or 56. Wow. That's an unhealthy liver.
That's and so crazy.
When I see that, I'm like, I saw somebody with a uric acid of 7, and that was within the normal range. And their doctor said, oh, you're in the normal range, you're fine. If you have a uric acid of 7, you have a 35% increase of either a heart attack or stroke from baseline within that year. So a uric acid of 7 is potentially lethal. I mean, you're putting yourself at significant risk, or significantly increased risk of having a heart attack or stroke in that year if you don't get your uric acid down.
Wow.
All right. I am starting to get a little freaked out now.
It wasn't take much for you, though. I mean,
no, but it's...
Yeah, so... First of all, you guys just opened up a can. Do you have about 10 hours? Because you brought up lots of stuff, but I just want to talk about it for a second. And so, it is so difficult to go down the path that we go down, and it's not like you said, it's not because we want sympathy or anything like that, because we are passionate, we love what we do, and we're privileged that there's nothing else I'd rather have done, you know, to this moment, because it's the opportunity. Just think about what we do, and I don't know if you think about it in these terms. Sometimes I sit there myself in awe. Like, I'll just be sitting in the dark and about to be called into a surgery. And if you think about it, somebody is letting you take a knife, open up their body, and work inside of their body as surgeons. I don't think we think about that enough. Like the privilege, I mean, it's so deeply, deeply personal. And that's why our training has to be so rigorous and intense. Because if you're going to do that and you're going to be working inside somebody's body, manipulating things, in my case, working around the spinal cord and nerves, in your case, joints and this and that, you better have, you know, have been tested and put through the, you know, have your feet put through the fire, because otherwise, you know, it's dangerous. I mean, it is such a remarkable privilege. So it's not, I just want the audience to know it. This isn't because, you know, we want to complain about stuff and say, poor me as physicians and this and that.
Absolutely.
However, people have to understand, and I'm very passionate about physician burnout. I talk about it a lot, as you do. And I really respect you for doing that. I respect you for even sharing, you share about, you know, about your own story, but also, you know, are very compassionate about other physicians that are going through things. The physician burnout problem it's scary. And the reason that the American public, I'm almost done with my book that comes out next year, and it talks a lot about what we need to do to fix healthcare and this and that. But the reason that the American public needs to be alarmed at what's happening to us, and so they don't need to sit around and say, "Hey, poor guy," you know, he's, you know, because obviously, you know, the orthopedic surgeons do very well as far as the general population. So we don't need sympathy in that way. However, the fact that there, as you mentioned, the suicide problem, the depression problem, the anxiety problem, the feeling like we're commodities problem, the feeling like we're just another worker, even though we've given up basically our entire youth to get to where we are now, that is not just a us problem. It's not a Dr. you know, Molly and Dr. Sinacropi problem and our colleagues. It is a problem that affects the delivery of healthcare in the United States. So if you have a group of burnt out physicians who themselves are undergoing both mental and physical health problems at a rate that is alarming to me, and I'm trying to be at the forefront of helping my colleagues to combat some of these things, it does not bode well for how healthcare is delivered to other people. Because when physicians are dissatisfied, the care that they're able to provide to the patient population, the empathy, you talk about empathy burnout, all these other things, it becomes harder and harder to provide the solutions that we really need, because we need a whole body solution. And we'll get into that, because I'm a huge wellness advocate in addition to doing surgery. It has to be all combined.
So I have two more fun things that I want to talk about. One is your other passion, which is ballroom dancing.
Yes.
And it sounds like you get to make it. Is it always Italy?
I mean, it's Italy where I go, because my teacher, who is my, you know, also dance partner in competition, lives in Italy. So whenever I'm traveling to dance, it's to Italy, at least for part of the time. And then
it's horrible.
I know. so it's and then from a competition standpoint, we're usually competing, if not in Italy, someplace in Europe. So it really has also, this has completely changed my life. And it really kind of does balance things out a little bit for me, because I do have this, you know, this passion, something I really enjoy and get to do, you know, maybe would love to do it even more than I get to do it. But it does help when I'm at a point where I'm kind of at my breaking point with work. If I've got a dance trip coming up, it definitely helps, gives me something to look forward to. But yeah, it ended up being this international kind of long distance thing, long story behind it, but, it's a lot of fun.
What part of Italy do you go to for like your training and stuff?
My dance teacher, whose name is Roberto, is originally from, like the Tuscany area. So he lives in a small town in Tuscany called Cecina. So that's where I go. And, usually when we're doing, I do like a dance trip, I'm there for maybe a week or 10 days if I can spare it. And we spend days just training in the dance studio where he is there, where he grew up dancing since he was like 10 years old. And then we do usually kind of arrange the trip so that we can do a competition while I'm there. And, again, sometimes we travel outside of Italy to do the competitions as well. So
love Tuscany. That's actually where my family's from.
Okay. So, oh, very cool.
Years ago, in October 2022, I took
We took a huge trip. I took my parents. My parents have never been out of the country, wow. not even to Canada. Mm-hmm. And so we got to see like where my grandfather grew up, the house he grew up in.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
We got to see my great grandfather's uh-huh. tomb. And they're from the Tuscany region. They're yeah. a small town called Torsana, which is okay. on the top of a mountain. It's okay. near a bigger town, but it's very tiny, called okay. Caparagana.
Okay.
And the Italian culture is amazing. Yeah. Like, there is no doubt that at some point yeah. in my life, I'm going to have like yeah. mm-hmm. in Italy, maybe dual citizenship.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's been amazing. And it's, like I said, it's such a great outlet. I started taking lessons initially just for something kind of fun to do, because I've always enjoyed watch Dancing with the Stars, stuff like that. And then I had no idea that you could actually do what I do now. I didn't know there was such a thing as pro-am competitions where you have, you know, the teacher student dancing together. And when I learned of it, I'm like, I could see myself doing that. And then, you know, my teacher was here in the US at first. He was here working in a studio that's not far from where I live and work. And I just went for some like casual lessons, and then it kind of grew from there. And he was here on a work visa. And then that was 2018, 2019. And then COVID came. And so then he went back to Italy and stayed. And we had talked about the possibility of, you know, trying to continue, you know, even if he wasn't going to stay beyond his work visa, regardless of the pandemic. And we worked it out. It's a little bit non-traditional. I take lessons here on Zoom with him 3 days a week. And then I try to go 4 times a year. We try to compete 4 or 5 times a year. We do like a week in person, again, of like 6 hours in the studio, and then do each day, and then do a competition. And
so how are you doing? It's not like you dancing by yourself. You have a partner. Are you using
a stand-in?
Yeah. Or I'm thinking like the virtual reality or something like
yeah,
that?
No, no, it's hard to conceptualize at first, and we didn't know how it was going to work at first, but I actually just dance by myself. I actually use the waiting room of one of my offices. Our biggest office is my dance studio at night and on the weekends, because I really didn't have any other space. And I tried like renting a space in a studio, but it just wasn't very easy to do. So 2 nights a week, I go to my office, move all the chairs out of the waiting room. It takes me 12 minutes to do it. I've timed it.
It is those 3D immersive splats that we're creating in the meantime, as we're building the data for the Jarvis, right? As we're creating the data for the
AI. I don't want to go there, but can you talk about that, yeah, the Jarvis piece?
Peter, do you want to talk about the AI piece that we're
And before we do that, can we do something really cool?
Sure.
First time ever on the podcast, and this is, I think we need to put some gear on.
Let's do it. Yeah, here we go.
And we're going to show everybody what we're talking about,
because
we're
going to incorporate status that report.
Here we go.
Into the podcast.
Upgraded right now. Hey, here we go.
Start recording.
Make sure these are on.
Yeah.
Are they charged? Are you kidding me? These ones are dead. Oh, no. They're on. Just want to make sure we're synced up so I can.
There you go. Oh, wow. Those look great on you. You look like the new Superman.
What's up, guys?
1980s Wayfair.
Yeah, they call me Clark Kent.
So if we could, what I'd like to do is get everybody, because no one's ever seen this room.
Yeah.
And like what it looks like from this side. So that little thing that I started was called Through My Surgeon's Eyes, because I wanted my patients and other people to see what I see and get that experience of what it's like doing a surgery. Well, let's get the experience of what it's like doing a podcast.
Hey, yeah. Meta.
There's record. Lights.
There's wine.
Hey, Meta, record.
We've got this amazing room.
Hey, Meta, record.
Man, look at that. We're all recording right now.
Yeah.
Everyone's Johnny. Flashing. What's up?
There's T-Buzz. There's Peter.
There we go.
So you want to tell us a little, give us a little Jarvis background?
Yeah, absolutely. The ideas that will one day, I like to look at the future first, and then, you know, we can kind of walk into steps to it. I envision, like for you, one of your mentors is Dr. Lombardi, and I envision you having the option of talking to him during surgery and having him in your ear, maybe right here through the glasses, to discuss, you know, a question you might have, to theorize, hey, should I consider this? Should I do that? Maybe for him to remind you to like extend your elbow a little bit further. You're going to get tired in that position. Whatever it is that your mentor would have done. And then that's one piece of it. But you could also just say, like, here are my five great mentors that I want to see and hear from. And I could see a world where they are helping you, learning from you, you're learning from them. It's a discussion. But this is their AI. This could be, you know, beyond their retirement, but you're having that conversation. They're helping you. They're showing you things, and vice versa. You're showing them things.
And so, it's real time. The cool thing is like, we're going to augment reality with AI. And so you can be able to see the line cuts. If you're 1 degree varus, 1 degree valgus, right? If you're tight inflection, tight extension, and you're going to be able to have your mentor in your ear, be like, hey, you need to be able to cut a little bit right here. Or it's like real time talking to you. So the world renowned surgeons, or the really great hand surgeons, as Peter was saying, almost like a security blanket, like, hey, we got this. But like, if you have a question real quick, but then the community surgeon or somebody that doesn't have that, like they didn't get to go to Lombardi, they didn't get to go to somewhere great to be able to learn, they can have these glasses and be able to have this predicament and like go through it and be like, okay, man, I'm a lot better surgeon because of this.
Right? I will tell you that one of the most terrifying things, I'm going to start this again because I only got the 1 minute once. You know, when you first come out, and there's a quote that I absolutely
love. Johnny just got me the 3 minute ones.
I'm just saying, so. I'm like chopped liver over here with these 1 minute glasses. Anyways, by the way, those are mine.
Yeah,
that you're wearing. Just, I'm going to wipe them down with some alcohol pads when we're all done here.
Before I start going into it, something that you said, you know, about patients being unaware. And I like to believe, like, I have a really good relationship with a lot of my patients. So there were a lot of patients when I was out of work because of this reason that kept calling the clinic, like, hey, when's he coming back? I want to wait for him. I don't want to see a partner. And when I came back, they all were kind of concerned about, like, hey, what was going on? And a lot of them have seen that video now. And it was amazing to me about how nice they were and how caring they were, and like how much as a patient, which, you know, we're supposed to take care of, but how open they were to try to care for me and like, hey, is there anything that I can do? Like, you know, I'm sorry that you went through that. So that was really, really important to me, because one thing I wasn't sure is how healthcare professionals would take it. But also I was wondering like how patients would take it, and if it was out there, you know, would they abandon me, you know, thinking, oh, you know, I don't want to see him because he's got these issues going on. So yeah, for me, like I've always said, you know, like in the beginning, I loved my job. I loved operating. You know, if I was there late doing cases, it was great. You know, I loved the patients. I loved the workload. And, you know, like all of us, I just probably worked a lot more than I should have. And then, you know, around COVID, like all of us, and just prior to COVID, and you know, I started getting overwhelmed with the patient demands. You know, everybody wants to be added on. You got to add another surgery here or there. You know, you were losing sleep. And I think any surgeon that doesn't wake up at 2 a.m. worrying about their patient probably isn't a good surgeon. You know, and those things sort of tax you day after day, week after week. But then we ran into all the issues. You know, EMR, electronic medical record, has been shown to be one of the leading causes of physician burnout. So we're all dealing with the EMR. And then what we've seen over the past few years has been this issue of delay and deny by insurance companies out the wazoo. And then when COVID hit, we lost a lot of staff, like every place, and, you know, travelers came in. And then you also had the issue with shortages of supplies. So as the surgeon, you know, we're the captain of the ship, and our patient is, you know, the important person that we're there to take care of. And it's that thing where I think we differentiate between burnout and moral injury. You know, and this was moral injury. Like, I was doing everything that I normally do, and now I was doing more than I normally do because I didn't have the supplies. I didn't have the staff. I was on the phone with insurance companies. I was you know, that typical pajama time that we all talk about, you know, coming home late at night or on the weekends and doing my charting and in the electronic medical record. And it just really took a toll on me. And like we were talking earlier, I was supposed to give a lecture on burnout the week after I had my episode. And I had these, you know, slides of all these lists. You know, the other thing on there was a medical complication. You know, I've always prided myself and my complication rate was lower than the national average, but they're not zero events. So I had a patient that had an infection and a complication. So staying late, doing surgery, dealing with the patient, the family, the whole psychological issue of that. And that, I think a lot of patients don't realize what they're going through is one thing, but the surgeons also go through a lot when we're dealing with a patient that's got a complication.
Amen to that.
And then I got sued. So patient that had surgery at another institution came to see me for a second opinion. You know, I did the full Monty workup, got all his old records, you know, worked them up for infection, worked them up for loosening, you know, multiple x-rays, yada, yada, yada. But they blanket, you know, sue everybody when they sue people. And eventually I got dropped. But, you know, for any doctor that's been sued, you know, it's like another hit to the heart of like, you're trying so hard to do your job and do the best thing every single day. And when you get that, you just feel like you failed somewhere. And it's that issue that we all struggle with, the perfectionism that begins in college or maybe in high school.
And just this wild disparity, like, you know, everyone says like Medicaid, for example, is like a terrible payer and you can't make money in private practice off Medicaid, which I have differing opinions about. But then Centene Corporation, which is a Fortune 500 company that makes billions of dollars, almost exclusively is in the Medicaid business. So how can they be in the Medicaid business making billions while private practice is suffering and the people who need the care the most aren't getting the care that they need because Medicaid is such a bad payer and not paying people enough, you know, doctors enough money. So it's just this sort of overwhelming feeling of just such a disconnect between the business and like the practical medicine side. And then as the patient, I mean, I go to a hospital or a health, like I'm just, you know, I'm sat there in the ER and everyone's kind of pissed off that I'm there or whatever else, or, you know, I'm getting rushed out and it's 4 minutes and it's like behind the computer, but I get it and I'm very empathetic to it. But if I go to a private independent doctor, you know, I can tell a difference. They spend the time with me, they talk to me, because, you know, despite you, as you mentioned, not having like a formal business background or that education, I think so much of business is far more simple and practical than they would have you believe.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, costs you X amount of dollars to open the door every day. And as long as you see the right amount of patients and you know how much money you're bringing in and you treat them nicely.
That's it. That's it right there. And
you know,
going back to the one book,
Unreasonable
Hospitality, was such a impactful, powerful book that I read, you know, a year ago, year and a half ago. And I had my whole leadership team read it. It's like, you said it right there. If you, and it's just like simple stuff that your parents teach you. You treat people how you want to be treated. And I always treat every patient, and I tell my patients this, I'm going to treat you as if you were my mom or my dad. And if you genuinely do that, the rest will take care of itself, right? You don't have to worry about, you have to keep an eye on the dollars and cents. And that's why I have a business manager. And I'm looking at those reports and I'm very in the know with the financial health of the practice. But you can't make that your goal, right? It's, if you deliver, for me, it's an experience for my patients. I want them, when they walk in, to be like, holy crap, look at this building, look at this team. And we get it every day where it's like, your team is amazing here and at the hospital because we're passionate about it. We're committed. It's a culture that we've created. Yeah. It's tough. And to maintain that culture is work every single day. It's not like there's unicorns and rainbows everywhere, right?
And just for fun, market initiatives are kind of how you upend industries, right? They're the iPhone, they're the Amazon, right? They're the new thing that doesn't care about anything that's been done previously, right? Like in the insurance market, initiatives aren't like, hey, can I save you 10% on your employee benefits, right? Like, I'm like, okay, but like 90 guys called me last week to do that. Like, what's that going to do for me, right? Like, show me how to run my practice. Give me like really good concrete steps. And whatever I can't do, like, I need you to give me somebody in my office that could do it for me, right? And so one of the big challenges we have is look, we got to fight the health systems, right? And so one of the things we're working on is, let's pick on Philly. Philly's a place that I want to pick on. So you got UPMC, right? They're the big dog. They're humongous. Like, they're a pretty formidable foe.
I know a little bit about them.
All, yeah, yeah. Like, I'm going down there next week, and it's like, okay, well, how do we fight them? And so I say to these docs, right? I'm like, well, why don't you guys get together? Well, they're like, well, you can't do that. I'm like, you can do that, and here's how you do it, right? And so in three other states, we put coalitions together of more than 500 physicians under one tax ID. Now, do I want to tell those docs what to do? Absolutely not, right? So I'm like, okay, well, how do you find a solution that leaves docs to have their own autonomy, be their own boss, but just for the sake of being able to contract together, right, against the payers, and being able to build our own full benefit stack, right? So if UPMC has a network and an insurance offering, why can't I get 500 docs together and build our own? Like, it's just really, like, everybody says, well, that's super complicated. I'm like, it's not complicated. I'm like, if I can do it, and I am not the sharpest knife in the drawer, like, in 10 minutes, I can teach you how to do it. And when I tell them and I show them, they're like, oh, it really is that easy. I'm like, yeah, how do you think insurance guys make money? Bro, it's not hard. This stuff is simple. You know, get 500 docs together, and now all of a sudden you're negotiating with payers, and all of a sudden you get a 20, 25% bump. Get 500 docs together, and now you can call the MA plans that don't pay you on time, that have pre-authorization problems. And guess what? You get rid of the five of them and you keep two, and now all of a sudden you don't have any problems, right? We did that in another state. And so I think there's a ton of solutions. I just want to try to figure out how to get docs to not compete where they don't have to. Like, if the three of us are in the same business, right? But we don't need to compete on HR. Why do we need to compete on benefits? How about property? Do we need to compete on who gets a better property deal from the insurance guy? No, we don't. We don't at all. But if we unite together and we put all of our ASCs together, I can, you know, because I'm an accountant, I can show you how we can net out our property coverage. Like, we won't have to pay a dime in 3 years.
As a disclaimer, this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions.